In the news.
Welcome to week 4 in the news for Government 310. I'm Professor Shaw.
I'm Professor McDaniel. And we have with us Dr. Josh Blank.
We decided that two people just wasn't getting it done, so we had to add a third.
Reinforcements.
That's right. Josh is actually a core member of the Texas Politics Project here at the University of Texas. And what's your official title, Josh?
Manager of Polling and Research.
That's right. So as we're pivoting away from institutions and toward processes, which is kind of where we're headed, we're doing institutions, right?
Yeah, we're institutions this part right now.
Processes. We've done it different ways over the course of our tenure here. But we're going to move towards public opinion and voting, and we thought it'd be good to bring Josh in because Josh, along with Jim Henson and myself and some other people at UT, are core elements to the University of Texas Government Department Texas Tribune poll. And so we're just out of the field with the survey. I guess it came out last week?
Yeah, June 11th it came
June
out
11th.
Of the field.
And right.
We just finished releasing it.
Right, and the Texas Trib poll is a survey that's conducted online with the help of YouGov. We've been doing it since, we can't even remember whether it's 2007 or 2008 when we first started doing this, but
yeah.
It's the most consistent publicly available poll of the state of Texas. Three per year, occasionally there'll be a fourth, especially in an election year. It's a survey of registered voters. Started with about 1,000 registered voters in the early days and bumped it all the way up to 1,200 voters per poll. And for those of you who are wondering out there, and we explain this in one of the modules later on, but how is it that you can ascertain opinion for an entire state of Texas, 14 million registered voters, by only interviewing 1,000 or 1,200? Well, you know, we like to use the soup analogy, you know, which is you don't need to drink an entire vat of soup in order to gauge the taste, the temperature, et cetera. You simply need a representative sample, a spoonful or a ladleful. And that's kind of what we do with public opinion polling. We dip in there, and as long as we're getting a representative sampling of the entire population, we can make judgments about how that public thinks about core issues. So we mentioned last week that Texas the legislature concluded its regular session. Are they in special session? Special session begins July 19th. So a special session called by Governor Abbott. But Josh is more intimately familiar with the numbers coming out of the legislative session than probably anybody. And we just wanted to bring Josh in to enlighten us. So what did you see coming out of the poll with respect to the state of Texas that caught your attention?
Yeah, and I mean, the end of session poll is a lot of fun because they just did a bunch of work. At the beginning, you know, you don't exactly know what they're going to do. You know, things that you think they're definitely going to do change drastically, but by the end of the session, you have a pretty good picture of what they accomplished, and you get to ask Texas voters what they thought about it. On a couple things that really jump out, I guess. I mean, I think if you were paying any attention during the session, you heard a lot of talk about the bathroom bill.
Right.
And especially the lieutenant governor's push to get a bill passed that would regulate transgender people's access to bathrooms, at least in public facilities, government facilities, schools, and things like that. And this is actually really hard to poll on in a lot of ways, partially because it's a really new issue.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways we did it, and we've done it a couple of different ways, was just to ask people how important it was to legislate bathroom access. This is something that, you know, the legislature should be spending their time on. And we asked it at the beginning of the session, and we asked it at the end of the session. And at the beginning of the session, you know, less than a majority of people thought this was important, you know, that we should be doing this. And at the end of the session, it ticked up a little bit, but the thing that was really interesting was that it really ticked up amongst the core groups, that the lieutenant governor and the Republican majority in the legislature who wanted this, you know, basically very, you know, the most conservative elements were trying to seek. So people who identify with the Tea Party, people who, you know, are fundamentalists in their religious views. Those were the people that they were reaching out to try to drum up support, because at the beginning of the session, there just wasn't a lot of interest. But by the end of the session, there's a lot more. So at the beginning, Tea Party Republicans, so people who identify with the Tea Party, only 39% thought that this was something the legislature should be doing. By the end of the session, 70% thought this was an important issue for the legislature to address. And you can see the way that, and you'll get into this, I'm sure, the way that public opinion gets led a lot by elites, and this is a really clear example of that.
Did you see any comparable movement on the left? Was it the case that Democrats reacted and also thought it was an important issue, or not so much?
You know, less so, but part of the thing that sort of defined this issue from go has been the fact that, you know, Republicans have been very clear in their attitude. So when we ask, you know, whether people, you know, transgender individuals should use the bathroom that correspond to their gender identity or their birth gender, Republicans overwhelmingly think birth gender, you know, 70% plus. Democrats have been a little bit more split, and I think this actually, again, reflects the national discussion, which is that there aren't a lot of Democratic politicians going out saying, this is what Democrats believe, or this is what the liberal view of the issue is. And so Democrats have been a little bit more, you know, ambivalent, we say, so, you know, a little on each side about this. I mean, they're definitely more liberal. There's definitely more support for, you know, using the bathroom that corresponds with gender identity. There's less, you know, sort of Democrats who think it's important that we regulate this. And it's moved a little bit, but it's still kind of, it's still not an issue for Democrats in the way that it is for Republicans, or some Republicans.
It's an example, and I think in some ways, of what we call a wedge issue. Now, it's not a classic wedge issue, but bear with me for a sec for definitional purposes. So when we talk about wedge issues in politics, they're generally issues that one party supporters are almost unanimous in favor of, right? So in the case of, let's just take voter ID is another example of a wedge issue where Republicans almost universally think that, yeah, it's reasonable to ask people to present a photo identity, identification piece when they're going to vote. A lot of Democrats agree with that also, you know, 50, 60%. So
it was higher, I mean, right. At one point.
Yeah, that's right. In that sense, it is a wedge issue where one party's coalition is in favor and you're driving a wedge to the other party's coalition. That's what we mean by a wedge issue. Some people think wedge issues are terrible and they're divisive. I actually have a high degree of tolerance for wedge issues. It's kind of what politics are about. In the state of Texas, Republicans, the last couple of cycles at least, have really kind of pushed these wedge issues. In fact, you could make an argument that they've overplayed their hand on them. In other words, whether it's partial birth abortion, whether it's voter ID, whether it's the bathroom bill.
Sanctuary cities.
These are issues where Republicans are unified, Democrats are divided, but if you push them and frame them and kind of, you know, really go to the mat on them, you can counter-mobilize people on the other side. And we've seen that on some issues. The bathroom bill is still kind of evolving, so it's not clear.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I think most people don't really have fully formed opinions on this issue yet. And so that's why, I mean, in some cases, those are actually the issues where elite opinion is most important, right?
Yeah. So, and we'll talk a lot about this when we talk about public opinion, but, you know, Josh and I have both kind of knelt at the altar of John Zoller and Philip Converse. These are political scientists who really believe that mass opinion is in large part driven by how elites frame issues and how elites present these sorts of issues. So we're not completely in that camp, but that's a dominant perspective in political science, that mass opinion really reflects the conversation at the elite level. And so if you want to really figure out where the action is, you look at how the state legislators and national figures are talking about this. Well, let's pivot to national politics then. You also have some questions that we asked Texans about the national situation, issues, stuff like
sure.
that. What pops out from that perspective?
I mean, maybe two things. You know, one would be, you know, we pulled on attitudes towards the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and also towards the American Health Care Act, I guess, the
right.
AHCA.
ACA.
Which, AHCA.
AHCA.
Right. So that was the bill passed by the House earlier right. this year, and that the Senate is now today, I guess, sort of unveiling their version of. And the interesting thing was, you know, a lot of the trends that we saw nationally, we also saw in Texas. And that's a lot of what we end up doing, remind people that Texas isn't this totally distinct, unique place. It is distinct and unique, but it's still part of America, mm-hmm. and the attitudes still fit in that context. And so we saw some of the same trends here that we've seen elsewhere, which is that, you know, attitudes towards the ACA got slightly more positive here. They're still more negative than positive, you know, which just sort of reflects the partisan distribution of the state and the partisan distribution of attitudes towards the ACA. But ACA attitudes got more favorable, you know, in recent time, and that's mostly driven by Democrats and liberals, and sort of more Democrats kind of realizing that this is going to be changed or repealed or whatever, saying, you know, actually, we do like this. Republicans still overwhelmingly dislike it. Having said that, nobody likes the AHCA. So what the Republicans passed in the House earlier this year and was roundly criticized and had these CBO scores that said that, you know, 20 plus million people were going to lose health insurance, and people reacted to that as you'd expect them to. That's also true in Texas. It's not as though Republicans are sort of falling in line behind the party proposal and saying, yeah, this is good for us, or we like it. The other thing I think is interesting is we did some early polling on the Senate race here. We didn't do a trial ballot because it's really early, and that's where we would say, you know, who would you vote for in this election between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, assuming they're the nominees, which they most likely will be. And what we found was we did a sort of name identification. We did a fave unfave. Do you have a favorable, you know, positive or negative opinion, basically, of these two people? And Ted Cruz is an interesting story, but I'll talk more about Beto O'Rourke, which is there's a lot of national interest in Beto O'Rourke. when you look at his favorability numbers in Texas and whether people have, you know, feelings towards him, over 70% of Texans have no idea who this guy is, yeah. is the most important thing to understand about where this race stands.
And he's a congressman. It's not...
He's a congressman.
And Republicans don't actually hold any statewide offices. They don't have any... So,
Democrats,
but yeah, he's a,
right.
Right, Democrats, right. Right. And so... He's a congressman. He's and we have a lot of districts here. So
yeah, and he's way out in El Paso. I mean, right. you know, he's not even sort of in one of the bigger, you know, Texas right. cities. And so what's interesting is that you know, you can look at his numbers and compare them to Wendy Davis at the same time period when she was coming off of her big abortion filibuster, and maybe you know millions of people watched that filibuster. The president tweeted about it, and about the same share of people knew who she was at that point in time. Mm. So you could say actually argue that he's actually doing kind of well in some ways. I mean, the main difference for him and someone who kind of watches this stuff is noticing how much attention he's getting. You know, there's Vanity Fair articles being written about. There's New York Times articles being written about Beto O'Rourke and Texas. And part of that is just people, you know, fomenting at the idea of Texas turning blue. I mean, it's a constant thing here. But also it is the only group where Beto looks significantly different from Wendy Davis is with self-identified liberals. Whereas Wendy Davis, basically still 70% of liberals know who she was, and maybe you know 20% have a positive opinion of her. With O'Rourke, he's about 45% of self-identified Texas liberals have a positive opinion of him. And I think that's what's driving a lot of this sort of early excitement and coverage, because amongst a certain subset of Democrats, they're very excited. Right. But it's a small sliver of the Texas electorate.
Right. Right. So moving forward, I mean, so we're talking about Wendy Davis, as it was the Democratic nominee to run against Greg Abbott in 2014. Beto O'Rourke is a congressman from El Paso, and he's the front runner and pretty much the...
He's the only one in the race
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, right. So, if I were to declare, I would be the number two at this
right.
point. So, yeah. But there's always a lot of excitement. Cruz took on a lot of water, I think, over the course of his presidential campaign. Is he vulnerable?
No. I mean, he is an extremely popular Texas politician before he ran for president. He ran for president, and that's necessarily complicated. You're making, you're distinguishing yourself amongst other Republicans. You know, there was the fallout of, you know, how he handled the aftermath of that race. And that drove down his numbers a little bit among Republicans, but they've mostly recovered. His numbers look a little worse overall, but that's because a lot of Democrats who had no idea who he was found out who he was and found out that they probably don't agree with him on, you know, most every issue,
right?
Right? But the fact is the vast, vast majority, you know, 80%+ of Republicans have a positive view of Ted Cruz. And as of right now, Republicans make up a majority of the voting electorate. So, you know, and you would say there's that on the one hand, you know, Beto and the liberals on the other hand, you know, I'd place my bet on, you know, the party that's won every statewide race for 20 years.
Right. And that, of course, is a profound difference. You know, the movement of Texas into the Republican column and its emergence as maybe the preeminent red state is very unusual historically. Texas was a bulwark of the solid South, the Democratic South, for years and years after the Civil War. And that began to change in the late 60s and into the 70s, and then really changed locally at the state legislative level in the 1990s, such
yeah,
that as, yeah, since
yeah.
as Joss mentioned, you know, we haven't had a Democrat elected to statewide office since 1994, I believe. You still had Bullock, I think.
It's 94. I mean, that's what it
yeah.
was. I mean, I think Ann Richards
was Bush.
Last state.
Yeah, it was the last governor was Ann Richards, and then Bush came along. And so, you know, Democrats are still eyeing it, and, you know, we may be turning Texas blue, but It's a slow process.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important to note is one of the things that Dr. Blank keeps mentioning is the voting is the people who are actually voting.
Right.
And so everybody keeps arguing like, well, no, if you look at the population of Texas, you know, the Democratic Party should be very successful. But the problem is a difference between the population and the voting population. And so many of these individuals, which people are saying could help the Democratic Party in Texas, they are not turning out to vote. And so it's very important to be aware of not just who the citizens are, but who are the voting citizens, because the voting citizens are really the ones that are most important. And so I think this is an extremely important point to make. And it also kind of points to maybe some problems with the Democratic Party within the state. So if you look at kind of, you know, what happened with Wendy Davis's case, if you think of, you know, nobody elected to a statewide office for the past 20 years, it could be a sign that the Democratic Party is in a bit of disarray and that it needs to reorganize itself along multiple lines, not just within the legislature, but also amongst the electorate.
Yeah, I mean, the Democratic Party here is an interesting thing. I mean, you know, I certainly have no problem saying that the Democratic Party here is in disarray or is ineffective, or, you know, I'm talking about the party organization, right? But the other thing is that, you know, attitudinally, the Democratic Party in Texas is just a lot more heterogeneous than the Republican Party. I mean, in the wake of Trump's election, everybody was focusing on college-educated and non-college-educated voters. And amongst Republicans, when you look across all the issues that we poll in this poll and the previous polls, and you look at college-educated Republicans and non-college-educated Republicans, their attitudes are basically indistinguishable. But among Democrats, they're significantly different. And especially, and there's two reasons for that. I mean, there's two, there's the description of it, and there's a reason for it. If you look among Democrats, non-college-educated Democrats are just more conservative. And also, Democrats in Texas are generally just more conservative than Democrats nationally. But also, college-educated Democrats are overwhelmingly female also. And so, like, that in and of itself within the coalition makes it really difficult. But then there's this idea of someone like, you know, the Beto O'Rourke brings up this point, you know, how do the Democrats mobilize minority voters who are less likely to vote, galvanize liberals who, you know, are, you know, definitely going to vote, but then also appeal to non-college educated Democrats who tend to be more conservative in the state? And it's just, you know, as much as we can kind of complain, you know, people can complain about the weakness of the Democratic Party, it's also just a hard coalition to mobilize. And Wendy Davis found that. I mean, that's part of, you know, some of her difficulties.
Right. A couple things just to point out before we leave this topic. First is, as Professor McDaniel pointed out, if you look at the demographics of the state of state of Texas, we're pushing close to 40% Hispanic at this point in terms of the population. I think we're in the
It's 39.
Yeah, 39. I was going to say very, very high 30s. If you look at the registered voter population, we're talking about 27-28%. If you talk about the electorate, it's 17 or 18% Hispanic. And so what happens, and you be careful of this when you look at polls of the state of the state of Texas. If it's a poll of adults, you're going to be shocked. You're going to say, oh my gosh, there's support for all these liberal policies, and it looks like it should be, you know, a very competitive state. Well, the adult population, the party, you know, the party structure is fairly even. When you start talking about registered voters,
it's majority minority, too.
Right, it is majority minority. And then when you move it to registered voters, it becomes more Republican. When you look at actual voters, it becomes decidedly Republican. And we also want to raise a distinction within the racial and ethnic minority groups. With respect to African Americans, registration rates and voting rates are essentially on par with the proportion of the population. So in other words, you're talking about, you know, a population that is now shrunk down to, I think, about 9% African American in the state of Texas.
It's actually about 11.9.
About 11%. Yeah. But that's true with respect to the population, the RV or registered voter population, and the likely electorate. One of the things you guys, you know, with all the talk about voter suppression, which is a separate issue, when it comes to turnout, African American turnout is on par with whites. In fact, if you control for socioeconomic status, blacks actually out-participate whites, and that's been true for a while now. It's not just an Obama function, okay? Latinos, Hispanics, are much less well incorporated into the party system. There are lots of, you know, Latinos who are not registered to vote, and lots of registered Latinos who don't vote. And I think, you know, when Professor McDaniel and Professor Blank talk about, you know, Latinos and the Democratic Party not being able to connect as much with them, it's true that, you know, about 65-35 Latinos identify as Democrats, but their attitudes towards the party are much... They're sort of ambivalent. They're just not that fired up. Their turnout rates are lower. And so when we talk about turning Texas blue or wakening the sleeping giant, which is the metaphor we always hear about the Latino population, it's not clear that the current constellation of issues or things they talk about is all that effective. And I think that's one of the big questions moving forward, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things people pointed out when it comes to why black turnout is so high is because you can, like, pinpoint specific court cases, things of that nature. When it comes to Latino vote, it's been a little bit more mixed in the state. You know, they were allowed to, they weren't allowed to. But then also one of the key things is, okay, what are the institutions? And that's been one of the key things that I don't really think has been fully addressed. Like, what are the institutions you need to do? You need to get in contact with in order to get these groups mobilized and out to vote? And so we know certain institutions to get Republicans out. We know certain institutions, especially white religious conservatives, to get them out to vote. But what institutions do we need to work with in order to increase Latino turnout?
Okay. Yeah, let's. We're going to come back to some polling things, but we're going to actually move to the national level right now. And I want to cue up an interesting thing that Professor McDaniel and I saw this week. Frank Luntz, who's this Republican pollster. He does more focus groups than polling these days. But I actually think he does a pretty good job running these focus groups. And he did it was like a half hour, an hour show that aired on CBS, talking to self-identified Trump voters. And he was sort of plumbing, what are their feelings? Are they still with Trump? Why are they still with Trump? So we got about a 6-minute segment that talks about this, and then we'll come back and kind of, you know, connect it up to some of the things we've seen in the Texas poll and national politics. So we could roll that focus group from last week.
President Trump says the investigation into Russia's influence in the 2016 election is not interfering with his agenda. Mr. Trump tweeted yesterday, quote, "The Make America Great Again agenda is doing very well despite the distraction of the witch hunt."
Republican strategist and CBS News contributor Frank Luntz spoke with Trump supporters about what they think of the president's performance. The group had 13 men and 7 women ranging in age from 20 to 63. All of them voted for Mr. Trump in November. Their opinions of the president range from somewhat unfavorable to extremely favorable.
Did the Russians intervene in this election?
No, I mean, they didn't get into the voting machines and change votes. It wouldn't have made any difference one way or the other. Now, did they try to hack the election? We found out from the leaker, that woman, that yes, they did, but they weren't successful.
Should we be investigating this?
Yeah, but not for the purpose
of... It's already been investigated.
So you think we're done? There's nothing more to learn?
Why not learn more? But learn more. Don't do it for the purpose of overturning an election. Do it for the purpose of learning how we can put walls up, how we can keep...
Isn't that what's happening now?
If the Russians affected the election, then that means they changed the minds of the American people. Right. And that's not what happened.
The whole purpose of this is to have an investigation to see if there are specifics. Do you want to shut that investigation down?
Yeah,
Why?
I do. Because it's a giant, huge waste of time. If there's an investigation into this whole Russian thing, then it needs to be on, well, they physically went into our machines, hacked our machines, this whole hacking thing, and actually changed the election results. People read fake stuff on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram all day. Anybody could put that up. I could put it up. You could put it up.
Okay, so we're now in the middle of June. I want you to give me one word or phrase to describe Donald Trump. Now that we have some idea of who he is, give me a word or phrase to describe Donald Trump.
I'd say honest.
Determined.
Effective.
True.
Strong.
Productive.
Yeah. Tough SOB. Very authentic.
How many of you in this room love the tweeting? You think it's really appropriate for a president to do that?
It could be better.
Yeah.
It could be better. He needs to tone down the language a little bit, but the bottom line is it's his way to get the message out.
I would argue that Donald Trump shouldn't tone it down. This brash brand that he has is what got him elected.
You know, my thing is I'm so tired of people beating on Donald Trump. Donald Trump made his promises, he kept them, and that's the type of new leadership that we need.
And what has he accomplished?
What has he accomplished? He's done more in the last 100 days than President Obama done in the last 8 years.
Such as?
Such as keeping his promises.
I want to know what promises he kept.
One promise I can say that he did keep is he elected a conservative to the Supreme Court. Yeah. And you know what? That's the best promise that he's kept so far.
By this point, George W. Bush already had his tax cut done.
Good for him.
Plus,
Trump
is not getting
much help from Congress. He is not getting
a lot
of help.
It's a Republican Congress.
He talks about draining the swamp. And I think what we're finding real quick in the first 100 days is the swamp is not just the Democrats.
There's more fighting among the Republicans than there is between the Republicans and Democrats on his agenda. And if they don't get it figured out, 2018 is going to be ugly for the Republicans.
Who thinks he's going to be president for 8 years? Raise your hands. Let's say he doesn't get health care. Let's say he doesn't get tax reform. Let's say he doesn't get the investment in infrastructure. Those are three key commitments that he made. Who here would consider not voting for him in that situation? Raise your hands. So you're voting for him no matter what? No matter what. No matter what he does. I'm Donald Trump. What would you tell me?
Stay focused on the big picture issues and get that legislative agenda passed through on the economy, and things will get a lot better.
Stay true to the promises that you gave us.
Listen to your cabinet, and Democrats aren't your enemies.
Remember what got you to the office. Remember the people, the promises. We're results-oriented. We have to be in this critical stage of our country.
Frank Luntz is here now. Frank, good to see you.
Thank you.
We talked about this during the campaign. What you're hearing now in that piece is not that much different than what we heard during the campaign.
It's not different at all. It's just more passionate, and the divisions are just so much deeper. The Trump voters, what surprised me the most about that segment is when we showed Trump pushing aside the European leaders at that meeting, and they applauded him. Mm. They loved it, because to them, it was the White House, it was the president asserting his rightful role as leader of the free world. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is one of the most embarrassing moments. They don't see it that way.
The push asides, the handshakes, all of that. They love it.
They love it, and they want him to keep doing it.
Are we talking about simply the hardcore, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, people right. who voted for him? Or are we talking just about them, but also those Democrats who came to vote for Donald Trump and put him over the top in 2016?
His base is significant. It is small but significant, and it isn't weakening. Those who are independent.
Is the base enough, and is it all of what elected him?
No, it's not enough. You cannot govern successfully at 38%. Your goal is to be at 50.1. This is the first president I know in modern history that accepts 40% as the center place. That's a challenge for him in getting tax reform. It's a challenge for health care. It's a challenge for infrastructure. That said, the people who voted for him are still behind him, and you can see that emotionally.
They are not behind the Republican Party, though. There was sharp criticism of what's happening in Congress. What are the implications for 2018?
We're going to be showing this tonight at 9 o'clock, and Paul Ryan better tune in, because it is the most significant condemnation of the speaker since what I heard Trump voters saying about John Boehner about 2 years ago. They think Congress is holding up the agenda. They think Congress is part of the swamp, and they blame the Republicans as well as the Democrats.
So where are we going to show this at 9?
At 9 o'clock on CBSN. Now I feel like a pitch man.
No, I want to know.
Yeah, we want to see it.
9 p.m., 1 hour of this.
Great.
Frank Luntz, thanks as always. Great to see you.
Pleasure.
Okay, there you go. That's Frank Luntz's focus groups talking with Trump voters. You know, Dr. Blank, what do we see in Texas? Do we see anything like what you're seeing there in the focus groups nationally?
Yeah, I think we're seeing something pretty similar. I mean, those national numbers, I think he was at 39-55 in terms of his job approvals. That's approved, disapprove. And here in Texas, he's at 43% approved, 50% disapprove. And again, that's, you know, that's everybody. Right. But the key here is, you know, there's a huge, huge partisan division. So 80% of Texas Republicans approve of the job that Donald Trump is doing. 90% of Texas Democrats disapprove of the job he's doing. And we see this across a range of questions we ask about him, you know, whether he's honest, whether, you know, he's got the temperament for the job, whether he's competent. You know, we ask all these questions, and generally speaking, this is the sort of the structure of opinion. There's, you know, vast majority of Texas Republicans think he's doing a fine job and kind of, you know, agree with the approach. So now the question is, and I'll turn this back to you in some ways, you know, it's, you know, how much of this is, you know, how do you take these sorts of opinions? I mean, how much of this is, you know, given sort of the range of, I kind of know what I think, but, you know, oh, here, well, I'll do it real quick. No, you go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, look, a lot of what we're seeing, if we're talking about this from a political science point of view, is what we would call confirmation bias. And that is people kind of have an evaluation, they're prone to really like people on their side of the game, and they view events, they selectively view events, and then to the extent that they take in new information, they filter it through, you know, sort of mental processes that make it fit with their pre-existing notions of what's going on out there. And so, you know, if I see Trump, if I'm a Republican and a Trump supporter, and I see Trump kind of muscling aside European leaders and getting to the front, well, that's showing leadership. It's not being rude. It's not being insensitive to people that we really need to make things work. And if I'm a Democrat and I don't like Trump, I'm just aghast that no president's ever done this, and this is awful. And I think one of the things that's sort of interesting in Texas is that Trump underachieved in 2016. He won the state comfortably, but comfortable in Texas, 11-point margin, that's half of what really dominant Republicans do in Texas. And so I think it's interesting that some of the Texas data suggests that this kind of tribalism is actually reasserting itself. I don't know that Trump's ever going to be a figure like George W. Bush or even Rick Perry in Texas, but you know, he's actually moving more in that direction despite all these controversies and scandals that have plagued the early days of the administration. Yeah.
Well, I think it goes back to some stuff we were talking about populism last week, where populism is really about dividing, you know, the pure people versus the corrupt elites. And you clearly see this coming out of the arguments about Congress. It's like Congress, these are the corrupt elites. And, you know, we are the pure people. We're not being listened to. And so the attack on Boehner, the attack on Paul Ryan, is this is the leadership of the corrupt elite. And I also think what's important here is, again, if he's not doing that well in Texas, again, you shouldn't expect him to lose. I mean, another election, probably shouldn't expect him to lose in Texas, but might this reverberate to mean something for the Republican Party in Texas? So if you think about how the Democrats lost control of the state, it really started with national politics, where you see in the 1930s and 40s, the Democratic National, the state party actually endorsing the Republican president. So they endorsed Eisenhower, they took stances against Truman and Roosevelt. And so, you know, might you see this going on where, you know, the unpopularity of Trump actually may create some division within the Republican Party and may help the Democratic Party. I doubt it, but
I mean, the major difference there, right, is that, you know, the action in Texas politics has always been in that sort of center-right category. When that center-right was part of the Democratic Party and the National Party became much more liberal, that's when they bolted, right? Yeah. You know, here the thing is that Texas has been moving in this more, you know, purely conservative direction, kind of election cycle after election cycle, and you kind of look back at sort of, you know, replacing, you know, Kay Bailey Hutchinson with a Ted Cruz,
yeah,
replacing Lieutenant Governor, you know, David Dewhurst with a Dan Patrick. I mean, there's been a much more of a push towards, you know, really pure conservative leadership, and I think that's sort of why, you know, in a lot of ways, he wasn't, you know, Trump wasn't as strong here as we were polling kind of running up to the election. I mean, the people who you'd expect to support him who were a little bit reluctant were the, you know, sort of the extreme conservatives, people who identify with the Tea Party. But they've come back,
yeah,
you know, fully. Mm-hmm. And that is the tribalism piece, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to mention one thing before we move on, and that is a couple of special elections. A number of elections this last week were held to replace people who had taken positions in the Trump administration or in the Trump bureaucracy. Two in particular, one in South Carolina, Republican maintains a hold on a fairly Republican district. And then the one we're really interested, though, in was this race in Georgia 6. Now, for those of you who are kind of new to this or only tangentially pay attention to politics, not that there's many of those of you out there, but Georgia 6 is sort of a famous district. It's in suburban Atlanta, kind of the affluent suburban Atlanta in the north part, Buckhead and some of these other places.
You want to move the Braves new stadium
too. Yeah, right, and actually kind of pushing towards, my son's at Georgia Tech and I visited some of these places as we were kind of going to the Georgia History Museum and stuff, and there's some money out there. I mean, it looks like, you know, the Masters, basically.
Yeah.
Right, and this is a district that was formerly held by Newt Gingrich, former Speaker Gingrich in the 1980s, and then was vacated by another Republican, Price, who's now at HHS, I think, Health and Human Services. So it's been it is, although it's gotten more competitive, it's still a plus 10 Republican type district. But Trump did not run very strongly in the district, and a gentleman named Ossoff, who's about a 30-year-old guy, sort of an attractive Democratic candidate, almost won the initial special election. The way it works in Georgia is everybody's sort of in the race and the top Republican and Democrat advance unless you win 50%. Ossoff almost won 50% in the preliminary election, but he didn't.
I think there were 12?
I think it was seven, 17 candidates.
More than a dozen candidates, so yeah.
Right, and so that meant because there was no majority winner in the first round, it goes to a runoff, and the runoff was between Karen Handel and this guy Ossoff. Handel, the Republican, Ossoff, the Democrat. I believe, and you can check me on this, I think Ossoff, this is probably both rounds, spent $23
million. I think the total was like $50 million, and he had spent more. I mean,
all
money spent.
It's the most expensive House race in American history.
But there are multiple steps to it, so that's one of the more important things. Right. People can think it's a one shot, and
this includes
two steps to it.
Not simply candidate money, but all these affiliated groups had poured money into the race, including the Republican National and the Democratic National Party committees. And Handel ends up, the Republican ends up carrying the seat by about 4 points, mm-hmm, slightly overperformed her performance. The polls basically showed a dead heat, maybe trending a little towards Handel at the end. But it's another case in which you know, with the Montana special election, with the South Carolina special election, that, you know, how do you make it? It's on the one hand, Republicans should be winning these seats big.
Yeah.
And they're not. On the other hand, they're not losing.
Right. And your reaction is actually pretty atypical, because most people are coming at it from the other side, which is to say, oh, you know, I mean, basically all of the liberal commentary is a mixture of people pulling their, you know, hair out and, you know, setting things on fire, saying, oh my God, right, we're not winning these seats. How is this not happening? But it's also, you know, I mean, this whole thing is kind of, you know, there's this, I don't know, media desire to read into these special elections as somehow telling us something real about what's going to happen, you know, in the midterm elections or in the next presidential election cycle. And there's nothing normal about a $50 million special election house race.
In suburban Georgia.
Right. It's just, there's nothing about that. And most of it is, you know, people looking for something to write about and trying to draw out some sort of broad conclusions. I think that the only thing you can read that's smart about this stuff is to say, you know, here are the races that, you know, Democrats won before the 2010 midterm and these special elections that came up before that one, and then they lost the House. Mm-hmm. Or here are the elections that Republicans, basically won in the wake, basically after 2004, and then they lost the House in 2006. I mean, yeah. And it's not to say that that's what's going to happen. The point is just to say they're just not predictive of anything.
We're getting more and more attention. So if you think of the Kentucky race, in which Mitch McConnell and his opponent, they spent close to a billion dollars was spent on this.
In the 2014 cycle.
The 2014 cycle. So everybody keeps saying, oh, this is a referendum on this. But I think, as you pointed out, it's okay. It's normally a safe seat, meaning you win by more than, you know, by five points or more. Now all of a sudden, you're only winning by 3 points, so it's no longer a safe seat, which means that it may actually change your behavior once you get into Congress. There is evidence that, you know, that the less you win your election by, the more you put into constituency service, the more you're going to do certain things to try to make sure people are with you. So it may change behavior in a bit. So, yes, your party didn't win, but it may change the behavior of the person who was elected.
Yeah, we got just a couple minutes left. We try to keep these things between 30 and 40 minutes. And so we want to move on to two Supreme Court cases. One is simply a case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. And that's sort of my pick for the week. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a redistricting case for the state of Wisconsin. And it's consequential because, as we've talked about or will talk about in some of the modules that you guys will take a look at in the next, when we release sort of the third set of modules, redistricting matters. Redistricting refers to the way in which they draw the lines within a state for representation purposes. So, you know, which geographic areas are put together to form districts. And what's happened over the course of the last 50, 60 years in American politics is that there are increasingly fewer competitive districts. And part of that is a function of the way people live, but not all of it. A decent proportion of that is, you know, simply the legislatures draw lines to make incumbents safe. And what they particularly want to do is maximize the party advantage, right? So in the case of Wisconsin, Republicans are in charge of the legislature. The legislatures draw the lines. The majority party dominates that process. And after 2010 census, the Wisconsin legislature drew the lines in a way that maximized the number of Republicans they thought they could get elected. You might say, well, that sounds terrible. Well, it sounds terrible, but the Supreme Court has traditionally not gotten involved in these political redistricting cases. Note I distinguish here. Racial redistricting cases or racial gerrymanders, where you are marginalizing a group or trying to cram members of a group into a small set of districts, that's something the court has been willing to hear. But they have tend to view political or partisan gerrymandering as a political question. That's something that the court doesn't really want to touch. Now they're going to touch it. Now, they have had some cases in the past, Baker v. Carr, Bandemeyer versus Indiana, where they've ruled on political gerrymanders. But this will be an interesting case. It seems like the court, and the key vote here is the Kennedy vote. Kennedy is the swing vote in the court, Anthony Kennedy, and he has expressed an openness to reviewing these political gerrymander cases. And so you've got the conservatives tend to be, let the legislatures decide. The liberals tend to be more likely to say, hey, you know, this is wrong. You know, we shouldn't do this. It's Kennedy who seems to hold the balance. So watch him. This will be a case in the next session. Now, you wanted to talk, Professor McDaniel, I want to talk about the Supreme Court decisions, so not just taken a case, they've actually decided on trademarks.
Yes. So this recent decision came down in Mattel versus Tam, and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously. So 8-0, again, Justice Gorsuch said recused himself because he did not actually hear it. They ruled.
That should never stop him.
Yeah, I would. Okay. You know, I'm like, hey, I wasn't here before, but you know, I would just Photoshop myself in. They ruled 8-0, but you really had an 8-0 decision in favor of the plaintiff, and so the case was about whether or not you could be denied a trademark because the trademark was offensive. And so we think, and so it was based upon a group, an Asian rock band. They called themselves the Slants. They wanted to trademark the name. They were told, no, you can't trade this because this is offensive. Now, this doesn't mean that they can't still go by the name, but it's whether or not the government will protect the rights to that name. So it's really a property rights argument. And this is also important for understanding another important issue regarding kind of offensive names with the Redskins. And so a court had ruled that got rid of some of the Redskins' trademarks. Now, again, not all of them, but some of the trademarks, except this is an offensive name, the government will not protect offensive names. Again, it's a property rights issue. Now, while they did rule in favor of the group, you did get kind of, you got two decisions coming out of this. And so you had one decision that was written by Justice Alito and joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, and Justice Breyer. And then you had the other one written by Justice Kennedy with Justice Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So you kind of had the conservatives over here, the liberals. And so they came to kind of two different decisions. They said, no, you should allow this name to go through, but the logic, for different reasons. Yeah. Which presents some interesting issues. Furthermore, it is also put forth, like, to what degree can the government control certain types of commercial speech? Now, if it's misleading, yes, they can control that. But if it's an offensive name, things like that, it's not really clear how that's going to work out. And so, again, it has expanded freedom of speech, specifically in regards to commercial speech. And the idea of that the government is now obligated to protect the rights of a name or a trademark, even if that name or trademark is deemed as offensive.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So this is it's the end of the session. As we've talked about in the lecture on the Supreme Court, the court session runs from October all the way through June, and now you're getting these decisions. Actually, we're at the tail end. So stuff that they heard in October, November, December, into January, they kind of fold up their tents and then go and they write opinions. They take votes and write opinions, and they're releasing these opinions right now. And Gorsuch was only in the mix at the very end and probably only waited on a couple of cases. But
he did write an opinion for one of the unanimous decisions that he sat in on.
And get his feet wet. Let him get in at bat late in the season.
That's right.
Yeah. So, all right, so that's all we've got for this week. We'd like to thank our very special guest, Josh Blank, for helping us out with public opinion in Texas and beyond. And any housekeeping matters we need to take care of? I think we're good.
No, I think we're great.
All right, so come see us during office hours, and we'll see you next week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.